I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is April Davila, author of the debut novel 142 Ostriches, published by Kensington. April and I talked about unreliable narrators, fictional settings, balancing narrative and scene, and more. Enjoy. Tell me about 142 Ostriches and how the book came about.
Yeah, so the book originally started as my thesis project in the writing graduate program at USC, and I had always known I wanted to write a book. I just started writing, not really having a good sense of what I was doing, even being near the end of my graduate program. And the stories that came up were mostly stories based on my mom's upbringing. She grew up with her mom in Oakland, and when she was 13, her grandfather showed up on the doorstep and said, "You know, you're doing a terrible job, and we're taking the kids to live on the ranch." My mother's mother. And she had all these very strange experiences on the ranch. Her uncles were really awful to her. And so when I started writing stories, these were the dramatic stories that came to mind. But I loved the desert, and I had always known that I read it in the desert. So I called my mom, and the farm that she had gone to live on was just outside of Sacramento. It was in a town called Elk Grove, and it was a dairy farm. And so I called her and I asked, would it make any sense to put a dairy farm in the desert? And she pretty much just laughed at me and said, no. But I was feeling stubborn, so I Googled farm in the desert or ranch in the desert. I forget exactly what I Googled. And I came across this ostrich ranch. And then, you know, as writers do, I pitched it as a travel story. And then I went out there to interview this guy, Doug Osborne, who had an ostrich ranch in the Mojave. It was an hour's drive from my front door. It was not very far. And the minute I got there, I just had this sense of, oh, this is the place. It was beautiful, first of all, because I love the Mojave and I find it very beautiful and inspiring. But second of all, the birds are so weird. They're these big, beautiful, graceful, deadly. They're just walking contradictions. And I thought, this is a great place to tell a story about family. So I started talking with him. And originally I had thought this would be a quick tour. And then I would go home and I'd write up the travel piece. And but I think he was maybe a little bit lonely because I ended up staying for hours. We walked the perimeter of the ranch. He started telling me all these stories. And so when I went home, wrote the travel piece, but then I started working on the novel again. And the stories that had been the anecdotes of my mom's growing up kind of gradually got replaced by these stories that he had told me about growing up on the ranch. And I just put my characters into his life on the ranch. So gradually, and you've read the book, so having read it, I can tell you everything that is in the book now is not my mom's story, except for one moment. And it's the moment when the grandmother, I made it the grandmother instead of the grandfather, because it's a very matriarchal story, shows up on the doorstep and says, I'm taking Tallulah to live on the ranch. You can come too if you want. That's the only moment that is true to life. Everything else just got rewritten to the point that it's no longer my mom's story. It's my story set on the ranch. And very loosely based on some family dynamics that came before I was born.
Yeah, as I was reading, I thought, oh my gosh, April had to have lived at this place. She had to have this history with ostriches. I mean, the setting and the ostriches are just, I mean, it's all character. You know, the ostriches, setting is character.
Yeah.
So yeah, you did that really well. You tricked me.
Thank you. Thank you. I actually, that's one of my favorite compliments is when people ask if I've ever lived on an ostrich ranch, which I haven't, but I did spend some time out there.
Yeah. I love the ostriches. I understand that they can be nasty and they're big and heavy and, but you know, there were a few that were very much characters, that I just loved. Abigail, I think, was one.
Yeah, she's my favorite.
Yeah, oh, it was great. So I guess I'm curious about Tallulah. First of all, the name. How did
you get the name? I love the name Tallulah. I don't remember how I initially came across Tallulah Bankhead. She was a dancer and an actor. I really wanted to name my daughter Tallulah, but my husband wasn't as big a fan. And so I started this book when my daughter was two, and I think I was just kind of looking for a place to put that name in my life. I just really liked the name Tallulah. And funny side story, my sister also loves the name. And so my niece, who was born in 2011, is named Tallulah. And so when my book came out in 2020, she was pretty sure it was about her. And I had to explain, it's really not, sweetie. I'd already named the character, but we can pretend.
That's great. I'm curious about the very beginning too, because, you know, so many novels and memoirs come through here from publicists and publishers. Mm-hmm. And I tend to open the book and just start reading. And so often I put the books aside because I'm just not taken enough. You know, there's just so many,
oh, yeah,
so many writers, so many books I wish I could do and can't. And so I am always compelled by the very beginning. And your first sentence, it was so compelling. 4 days before the ostriches stopped laying eggs, Grandma Helen died in an accident that wasn't really an accident. So talk about that. Was that always the first sentence? And how much attention did you pay to getting that first sentence, that first page, that first chapter, as wonderful as possible? Or did it all come out pretty naturally? Is what's on the
Oh, I don't know if you can hear me laughing. I wish that all just flowed out so naturally. No, thank you for the question. And thank you for the compliment. I did work very hard on that opening. I left it to the end. When I first started writing, I think a lot of writers do this where they feel like the beginning kind of is going to set the stage and they have to get it right. Somewhere along the way, I realized that I wasn't going to know what the beginning was until I finished the story. Yeah. I wanted the opening paragraph of my book to hint at everything that was going to come. And I didn't know what that would be until I finished it. So at some point I decided just to let it be really rough. I wrote the whole book. I rewrote it numerous, numerous times. But when I finally found the version that I loved, then I came back and really looked at the first chapter, the first page, the first paragraph, and particularly that first sentence, because I'm exactly the same way. When I go into a bookstore, if a book catches my eye, I read the first sentence. I don't even read the back because usually I don't want the story spoiled for me. I love going into a book not knowing what it's about, mm-hmm. but that first sentence is everything to me. So I labored long and hard, and there were many, many versions. And even once it was done, I remember working on it with my editor. So no, it did not flow easily, but it was worth the work. I'm happy with where it landed.
Yeah. I wonder about that because so often beginnings are, I don't want to put any sort of value judgment on what they are, but they just don't work for me, I guess is.
Yeah.
And so I'm always curious about that because it does seem that a lot of writers futz with the beginning too early because before they're even done with the draft.
Yeah.
And yeah. How do you know? I mean, until you reach the end of the book, how do you really know what the beginning should be?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you can at this point.
I mean, I understand wanting to know that, wanting to get the first page and the first chapter right, but so often you lose so much steam just going over it.
Yeah.
So many people don't finish the book because
because they're working on their first page. I also feel like some people, and I would include myself in this, that when you start a project, you have a sense of what you want it to be. And so if you write the first page, paragraph, chapter, whatever it is, of what you want it to be, you kind of lock yourself into avoiding tangents and exploration that can make a story so much richer. I learned so much about these characters just as I was writing, because I would have a random idea and be like, oh, maybe that's why she does this. And then it would just blossom into a backstory or a plot point or whatever it was that I hadn't considered.
So did you know, I mean, did you have it plotted out? Did you have some idea of where you were going or what the points were or the beats were that you wanted to hit?
I had a few images in my mind. Again, like the flashback of that I pulled directly from my mom's. I knew that was a big part of the backstory. I knew that Grandma Helen had died before the story opened. But I mean, even that, I wrote a version that was three generations. I told Grandma's story, and then I told the mom's story, and then I ended with Tallulah's story, but I ended up not liking that version. So I wrote a lot of versions of this book. I learned a lot writing it too, so no regrets, but yeah, I scrapped a lot of pages.
So how many versions over how many years?
Let's see, I graduated, so I turned in the first 150 pages of the manuscript to graduate in 2010, and I finished it in December of 2017. So I guess 7 years and probably 14 versions. I don't know, I would rewrite sections. I scrapped those whole first 150 pages. I kind of lost count of how many times I went over it. Because part of the problem was that I would start writing, I'd get to the middle and decide to go a direction and then change my mind. And rather than editing and going back, I would just change directions. I would decide like, oh, she's blonde now, and write the rest of the book with her as a blonde. So I would end up with these, like, yeah, it's a bad example, but I would end up with a book that was almost three different books. And then I'd have to go back to the beginning and try to figure out which one I liked. But then I changed my mind again halfway through. It was a total mess.
What kept you going?
That is such a good question. I had this instinct of wanting to share a story that was important to me. It's a story about a young woman coming to understand what's important to her. And I think I was going through a lot of that understanding myself if I was writing. I was a new mom. I was working full time. I was exhausted. I would get up every morning at 5 o'clock to try to work on this novel. And I definitely had moments of, why am I doing this? Really, why am I doing this? I'm miserable. I'm exhausted. But I just felt compelled. And I knew that every misstep I took, as frustrating as it was a misstep I would avoid with future projects, because I have a lot of stories I want to write. And I took some heart in the fact that I was learning lessons that I hopefully wouldn't have to relearn, and that future projects would be easier.
Mm-hmm. Well, has it always been in the first person?
Yeah. Yeah. That actually has been consistent.
Why that?
I don't even know. I think because it felt like such an intimate and personal story. Mm-hmm. I think I also maybe heard somewhere along the way that first novels should be in first person. And as like new young writers tend to do, they glom on to some advice that seems right and just stick with it. That one turned out to be right for me. So thankfully, it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. It pulled me in. The narrator definitely pulled me in. But, you know, I was having this conversation last night with a couple of friends about first person narrators and how they, by virtue of the fact that the narrator is telling the story, that the first person narrator is telling the story, that they're unreliable narrators.
Mm.
Did you think Tallulah is unreliable or was that a concern at all?
No, she feels that she's very reliable. I mean, that's her perspective on the world, is that she's the stable one. But I think as the writer trying to also see, so writing her in that way, but also trying to see that people are inherently fallible. We have our biases, we have our trainings, especially a young woman who was raised by a mother who didn't really raise her. Of course, she's going to have certain ways she responds to the world that aren't necessarily logical. They're more emotional. So I tried to walk a balance of her thinking she's very reliable and trying to line up the dots of her life in a way that makes sense, but operating unconsciously on a level that, of like every human, has been influenced by her environment and her upbringing and the challenges that she's faced.
What about the town of Sombra? Because that's a fictional town, yes?
It is. It's based on a very real town.
I looked it up. Where is this place? Okay.
It's based on the town of Oro Grande, or Oro Grande, I think it is, outside of Victorville. It's on Route 66. It is just a tiny little speck on the map. I decided to make it fictional because there's some things in the town that are real. Like there's a train that comes through town, which is really kind of dominates the landscape, both visually and auditorily, every time it comes through. And first few drafts, I had the train in it, and then I didn't like it. It felt purposeless and obtrusive, and I felt like cutting it made it no longer true to the town. So I just decided to fictionalize it and make it my own little town.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it also gives you a certain freedom, because then you can have things happen at places in the town and not worry. Yeah. Restaurants or bars.
Yeah.
Whomever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a bar in the book and there's a gas station, and the two people, proprietors of those, are characters. Those are not real people. It frees you up to just kind of imagine what is in a little town that you want to be there.
I have such a perfect image of the ranch, of the road outside the ranch, of the bar. I mean, yeah. Perfect. It was wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you.
What about the midpoint? I am always looking for the midpoint of a book, because so much has to happen right there. And of course it did in 142 Ostriches. Are you thinking about the midpoint, or is that a natural, there's that word again, a natural evolution of the story that, you know, like when we tell stories orally, there is a midpoint that we seem to find and pass over and get to the end of the story. In writing, I think it's a lot more difficult to find that place or to make that work.
I agree.
What do you think? Because right there in the middle of your book, there it is.
Yeah, there's actually a pretty big event in the middle of the book. I'm almost done with my second book now. And if two books can be a pattern, the pattern I've noticed is that the significant events in the middle of my books kind of creep up on me. I don't realize that this is that critical moment until I'm a couple drafts in, and then I'm like, oh, this is really important. And then I'm like, okay, here I am. I found the middle, and that seems to be how it has evolved for both books. With the first book, with 142 Ostriches, I, again, following advice as a young writer, get to the action, you know, get to the good part. I had actually started my book at what is now the middle. And I gave it, after graduating and finding a draft that I liked, I went back to one of my old teachers and asked if she would read it for me. And she very kindly did. And her first words when we sat down, she said, I think you started in the middle. I think you need to give about 125, 150 pages before you get to what you're calling your first page. And that was not what I wanted to hear at all, but she was absolutely right. And so my middle, actually, one of the reasons I think my middle works, if it works at all, is that it was the beginning, and I had put a lot of time into making it work as a beginning, as something that had, you know, flow and energy and innuendo and all the things I wanted to be. And so when it became the middle, it maintained a lot of that energy, and I think it helps carry the book through. With my second book, there was a lot more intention around it, because my second book's a lot more structured. It's a different kind of book altogether.
Interesting. I don't know if you have a copyright with you that you could read from. We didn't talk about
it. I do. I do, actually. Hold on.
That'd be great to hear you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I can read a section. I like to read from the beginning, just because I don't like it when people give away what happens. Yeah. And you'll notice I only really even talk about that one part about the grandmother being on the doorstep, because it's a flashback. It doesn't actually affect the narrative of the story. Awesome. So I'll read from this first bit. Let me just look at it. I'm trying to remember. I cut out some sections just to shorten it a little bit, and I'm trying to remember where I jumped in and out. All right. Let's see here. So 4 days before, chapter one. 4 days before the ostriches stopped laying eggs, Grandma Helen died in an accident that wasn't really an accident. It was a Sunday when almost everyone was in church, when the only other trucks on Route 66 were bigger than hers, their immense grills roaring toward her, then escaping one after another, until a tomato trailer out of Sacramento proved too enticing. She had nowhere to be, no appointment to keep, no need that would require a drive through the heat of the Mojave in July. She hadn't called up the stairs to ask if I needed anything from town. The last thing I heard of her was the rasp of her keys as she scooped them from the counter, the bang of the screen door as she left, then nothing until the phone rang hours later. Tallulah? The deep voice on the other end of the line hesitated. It's Sheriff Morris. I hate to tell you this over the phone, he said, but I wanted you to hear it from me. And I knew, just like that. In my mind, I could see Grandma Helen's thick hands urging her pickup over the double yellow lines of the narrow highway. I felt the perfect stillness that filled the cab, the way time slowed down in the moments before everything exploded in twisted metal. I pushed through the front door and sank onto the steps overlooking the rolling expanse of desert. The hot, dry air outside burned my throat and seared my lips. In the corral, the ostriches strolled past one another, their long, meaty legs unfolding with each graceful stride. Trying to decide how far I should jump from here. Let's see. Okay, so Grandma Helen had convinced me, after I graduated from Victorville High, not to go off to college like my friends. She even gave me a small raise for my work on the ranch, and at first I gloated about making money while my friends all took on debt. But as time went by and I saw online that they were making their way in the world while I continued to do the same shit I'd done for years, I got antsy. I applied for a job with the Forest Service, but didn't say anything about it to Grandma Helen, not until they asked me to come in for an interview. When I did break the news, she dropped her fork mid-meal and left the room. We didn't even argue. I cleaned her plate along with mine and reminded myself that I'd known she'd be upset. It would pass. Her objections ticked up a notch after I passed the physical exam for the job. She stubbornly insisted that she needed me on the ranch. When I argued she could hire someone to do my work, and for less, she grew sullen, hardly speaking to me for days. It wasn't until my final acceptance letter arrived, telling me I'd been temporarily assigned to a fire prevention hand crew in Montana, that her anger boiled to the surface and we argued about it. And the very next day, there I was. She had wanted me to stay, and when I said no, she put everything in my hands and bailed, knowing I was the only one who could run the ranch in her absence. It was a dirty trick. Back inside, I dragged Grandma Helen's address book from the table and flipped to the J. The first entry was for Joe Jarrett of the JJ Ostrich Operation out of Yuma. Joe Jarrett had been salivating over the ranch for decades. Every few years, he sent a purchase offer that Grandma Helen rejected without even reading. I dialed Joe Jarrett's number. Helen Jones, he said when he answered, apparently reading off his caller ID. His voice came through with such force that I recoiled from the receiver, a tickle boring deep inside my ear. No, I said, bringing the phone closer so I could speak. It's her granddaughter, Tallulah. We'd never met. I felt cold, but my palm was sweating against the receiver. Are you still interested in buying our ranch? I was taking that job in Montana.
Thank you so much. That was April Death. Yeah. Reading from 142 Ostriches, published by Kensington. Wow. So as you were reading, I was thinking about balancing narrative with scene, which you do really well in this book. And I wondered, you know, what did I wonder? It's a difficult thing. It can be a difficult thing for writers, I think, who are more comfortable, say, writing scene, and same with writers who are more comfortable writing narrative. It's finding that balance. Mm. Is that something you thought about? Is that something you had to work on? Is that one of the aspects of writing that comes more naturally for you?
For me, it is a tricky thing. And particularly the part where I get stuck, I feel like I don't worry too much about it. I feel like instinctively it more or less flows on the page. Where it gets tricky for me is when dialogue comes into it, because it's really important to me that readers not lose the last thing that was said. But and you know, for me as a reader, when I read something and there's some dialogue and then there's a digression and then a character responds and I can't remember what was said, I get frustrated as a reader. And so that's something I try to be very careful of in terms of balancing, say, inner reflection or scene work with dialogue and action, is making sure that the dialogue is not so widely dispersed that a person has to scan back up the page to figure out, wait, what were we talking about? Mm-hmm. So that's probably where I try to be most mindful of it. When there's not dialogue, I feel like it's easier to manage the flow between the two. And I don't know why that is, but somehow dialogue just really mm-hmm. trips me up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Are there writers or books that have influenced you that you would turn to?
Oh, so many. Absolutely. So there were a few books I would go back and look at. I reread Grapes of Wrath, something about just the parts where they're crossing the desert and things are just very bleak, and man, Steinbeck can really just write a sentence. There was a book called The God of Animals by Aaron Kyle. Mm-hmm. That was really inspiring to me. It came out quite a while ago at this point, but again, a young woman on a ranch. It's a horse ranch, so it's not really parallel, and it's not in the desert, but there's something about the young woman looking for her place in the world that book really captured for me. And then a mentor of mine, Janet Fitch, there were times when I went back and read sections of White Oleander, just mm-hmm. looking at, again, a young woman kind of looking for her place in the world. Of course, very different setting. She's very urban, Los Angeles, the story of foster families, a series of foster families. But the same idea of longing for home. Winter's Bone was also a big influence. I really love what that book does with its sparseness of writing. Woodrell, the author, he is a master at really getting across a lot with just a few words, and really good with dialogue, and dialogue that contains deep accented, if it would be spoken naturally, it would be deeply accented, but he finds a balance between actually writing it on the page and letting your mind fill it in. It's just really well done. Hmm. So those are some of the books I looked at.
Did you have readers along the way, or do you wait till you have a draft till you share your work?
Well, way, way back in the day when I was still in grad school, I had a writing group and they were great. We met actually well after grad school. We met for about 5 years every other week, and they read a lot of parts as they were first getting formed. But the group was kind of a victim of its own success. People got book deals and stopped having time, teaching gigs, stopped having time for our writing group. Mm-hmm. So no hard feelings. I miss them, but I know they're all doing well. These days, I tend to finish a draft and then my husband reads it. He's a filmmaker and an excellent storyteller in his own right. And he's really good with plot. So particularly if I'm struggling with something on the plot front, he's my first go-to. And when I've read it and he's read it and I've incorporated the notes he's given to me, then I take it out to a few friends and family. I have some friends and family who are voracious readers, and they are generally my first go-tos as beta readers and get their feedback. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if there's something specific that I feel like I'm writing into, like in my new book, I have a character who's deeply Catholic and I am not. So I asked a Catholic friend to read it and give me some notes. Just, did I miss anything? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about, the book came out in 2020, and guessing that the pandemic kind of messed up any book tour, right?
Pretty much. Yeah, it was like the worst year ever to try to launch a book.
So what did you do? How did you do a lot of online events, or what happened?
Yeah, I just tried to get creative. I had all these events lined up, and then they just fell like dominoes one after another as the shutdown came, because my book launched on February 25th and I did have a launch party. So I was lucky. A lot of people launched books that year and did not get to have a launch party. And that was a wonderful experience, because I mostly invited just family, friends who had been supporting me along the way. And it was really fun to celebrate with everybody. And then I did a few readings. I did one at Skylight and I did one on the east side and, or sorry, on the west side at Diesel. And that was when things started to shut down. So after that, things got canceled. There was this idea, I don't know if you had this experience, but everyone was like, well, once the shutdown's over, we'll get back to it. Thinking, you know, this will be a week or two, no big deal. And then we started to gradually realize that wasn't going to happen. A lot of them did end up going online, like I did the San Diego Festival of Books online. That was fun. There's a book pub called Rose City Books up in Portland that I was going to do an event at, and we did an online event. Most of it ended up going online. And I got creative of reaching out to other book clubs. I did some online promotions, like a buy one, get one free, where I actually just paid for the second book so that it could just try to get more books out into the world so people would read them. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting when my second book comes out to see how it compares, is I was really surprised by how long the legs were on the book. You know, the books, it's almost at its second birthday. And I just did an event with our public library. They chose my book as the book of the year last year. And so long after I thought anything would be happening with my book, I'm still getting people reaching out to me, and it's wonderful. And I guess I just never really thought about the fact that it takes time for a book to circulate out into the world. People need to read it, and they need to like it enough to tell their friends to read it. And then they have to do that. And it just takes time. And the fact that that is still happening, that people are still telling their friends about my book and people are still reading it, is, it feels really precious and exciting that the book, I don't know, publishers always hype up your launch date. I think I fell into the trap of, well, if I don't sell all my like million copies on the day it launches, then I'm a failure. Like I hadn't thought about how long a tail can be on a book. And presumably when I publish my next book, people might get curious about the first one again and go back and read that one. So yeah. It's been really interesting.
A bookseller told me a long time ago, he was a bookseller for Manchester Books? No, that's probably not the name of the bookstore. It's in Manchester, Vermont, in any case. And he said, you know, books are new to people who haven't read them, right?
Right, so, right.
Shakespeare, people who haven't read Shakespeare, that's new. That's a new book.
Right.
And yeah, yeah. We tend to think of, you know, what just came out. That's the new. No, it's, if you haven't read it, it's new. Period.
Yeah, period.
It's kind of simplifying things, but it's true. That's why books stay alive. People keep reading them.
Yeah. Well, and I, every year on my website, I post my favorite books of the year, and I do it without any consideration of publication date or anything. It's like, these are the books that I love this year. They were new to me. If you haven't read them yet, you totally should. And some of them are not, I mean, some of them are new because I try to read the books that catch my attention that are new, but many of them are years old, if not decades, and still very much worth reading.
Do you reread?
Not often. Kind of like you were saying at the beginning, you know, there's so many books in the world that I want to read that I very rarely reread. And I'm just like you said, if a book doesn't grab me, I don't lament putting it down. I'm just like, not every book's going to be for me. And every book I write is not going to be for every reader. You have to find what grabs you and makes you want to curl up and read. And if it doesn't do that, go find one that does.
I'm always amazed with people I know who will finish. If they begin a book, they'll finish it. I'm like, why?
Yeah. Why? Oh my gosh.
I invested time in 50 pages. No, put it aside.
Yeah. So that's not a reason to invest another 250 pages worth of time. Let it go.
Yeah, let it go. Well, what about, you know, I've been talking about this and I may end up writing a piece about this for the Authors Guild Bulletin, but I'm so curious about social media and whether it really sells books. It, you know, I don't know. I mean, agents and publishers want you to have a social media presence, and yet,
right?
What does it do for book selling? What do you think? What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's such a good question. Like, because yeah, we all get that pressure. You have to have a social media presence. But does it actually sell books? I don't think so. I mean, I think maybe a few. Maybe a couple. And I guess as a publisher, it's your job to make sure every book that can be sold gets sold. But I'll tell you, from my own perspective, right, if I'm scrolling through Twitter and someone says, buy my book, I don't. But there was one time actually where an author, I started following him because I liked his book. And he posted like, hey, it's launch day for my new book. And I hadn't realized he had a new book. So I clicked through and I bought it. And I bought it on his launch day. And it was probably, I helped a little with the sales numbers. And so there's an example. He got at least one book sale off of that tweet. So I don't think it's like raking in the money for us authors by having social media. But I do think being part of the conversation can be interesting. And I definitely will follow what other people say on social media about books. I think authors are very hard to trust on their own writing. Like everyone thinks their baby is gorgeous, right? But I think if someone else tells me on social media of like, oh, hey, I just finished this book and it was fantastic, I'm much more likely to go look it up. So I don't know. There's probably some benefit to it, but I don't think it directly leads to a ton of sales. It's a big question mark.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, if somebody else tells you on social media, I love this book, and you go, well, I'm going to buy that book, it's really word of mouth then that's sold
right.
It more than the author's social media presence. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, word of mouth is everything.
Yeah, it is. It is. And reviews. Do you read your reviews?
I had to stop because I was being obsessive. Most of them are very good, but of course you don't see those ones, right? You click straight to the one star. I have one star review, and their complaint is that my book is not about ostriches. They're like, I thought this would be a book about ostriches. And it's like, well, did you read the summary? Like, it's a story about a family. It's set on an ostrich ranch. So I had to stop because it was making me a little loony.
I
wasn't helping.
I can't read them. What I did, I think when Palm Springs Noir came out in July, what I did was somebody said, oh, you have a lot of good reviews. And so I think I went to Amazon and I squinted at at the page so that anything that didn't have 5 stars or 4 stars, I wouldn't see. It was like, you could just
ignore.
Yeah. And then after that, I'm like, you know, what's it going to do for you if you go and read these things? I mean, it's maybe, you know, a year from now or something, I will.
Yeah.
10 years.
Yeah.
But I'm always curious about, you know, some writers say, yeah, I read them. I never get good reviews and I don't care. It helped me grow a thick skin. And other writers, I can't read them ever. You know, I don't know. I think.
Yeah. I wish I wasn't even tempted, but I am sometimes. And then I'm very quickly reminded why I don't read them.
Yeah. Or they complain about the shipping or, you know.
Right.
You
know, yeah.
It didn't get here on time. 1 star. Okay. Anyway. So before we go, I wonder if you have any tips or pearls of wisdom for the writers who are maybe working their way through a project, working their way through versions of their novel, hoping to reach the end.
Yeah, it's such a big topic, isn't it? I do writing coaching, and one of the things that really helped me get to a point where I knew what I was trying to say with my book, and then I was able to see what I had and see what the edits were that I needed, was actually a mindfulness meditation practice, which it's called the 6-week Mindful Writer Challenge, and I was actually just putting together the promotional material for the next round of it that starts soon. And I was looking over this question of like, how does mindfulness meditation even affect writing? Because at first I didn't believe that was the thing that had changed my writing at all. There was correlation. I had started meditating regularly at the same time that my writing started to get good and I started to have some success with it. But I didn't believe that there was like a causal relationship there. But then as I started to pick it apart, I started to understand the different ways that, first of all, just quieting my mind and being able to focus. And then the second step was being able to recognize my inner critic. So one of the meditation practice that I do is called insight meditation, where you basically, you focus on an anchor like your breath and you notice the thoughts that arise. And so I started treating my writing as meditation, and I would notice the thoughts arising of like, oh, well, that was a stupid paragraph, or like, oh, you should just delete that, or, oh, you'll never amount to anything. And these little, that awful little voice that just pipes up and makes us doubt everything that we write. And I finally was able to just kind of bow to it and be like, okay, thank you for your opinion. I'm going to keep writing, and finally get somewhere with it. And there were other things that I learned along the way, but it really was such a game changer for me. Just like a 10 minute a day meditation practice, it changed everything. Now, that said, there's also a lot of craft I've picked up along the way. I am a big nerd for craft. I buy craft books. I watch YouTube videos. When I decide I'm going to put a book down, this is a new rule I started for myself a couple years ago. I have to decide why I don't like it before I let myself put it down. Mm-hmm. And as I've started to do that, I've started to notice things I can avoid in my own writing. So I'm like, okay, I don't care about this book. Why? The character doesn't want anything. And so I'm not rooting for them. I don't really care what happens to them. And so really taking apart books that I like and don't like to see what worked or didn't work. I love talking craft, and I love picking apart things that work, and I love writing exercises, and I really like working with other writers. So, yeah, I feel like I'm just rambling. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, you are. No, I love it when writers I talk to ramble, because you know, so much comes out in the ramble. is the meditation, would you consider that a ritual? Is that something you'll do before you start writing?
I do it as part of my morning routine. I don't really think of it as a ritual. My coffee is my ritual. I get up, I make myself a cup of coffee, I sit at my desk, and I write in my journal for one page while the coffee kicks in. And I am not allowed to look at my phone or open my computer until that ritual is done. And then if it's a day where I can write, and I try to write 5 days a week, I close my journal, I sit on my cushion for 10 minutes, and then I open my computer and I start writing. If I've been a good writer, I have left my computer open to the page that I'm working on. I've closed my email. At the end of the day, I try to close my email. I try to close all the distracting stuff, because the morning really is my best writing time. And so coffee, journal, meditation, and then directly into my writing for as long as I can write, which ideally is about 4 hours.
So during those 4 hours, you won't check your phone?
I try not to check my phone. I'm not always successful, but I try.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because I do a lot of writing longhand, first drafts longhand, because it keeps me away from the computer for one. And plus, I like using fountain pens and paper.
Yeah, me too.
But the computer and the phone, and it's so hard to stay away from, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'll put my phone on sleep mode, and I turn it upside down. Like, I try to make it as much an inanimate object as I can. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, I have kids, and so I occasionally do check, just like, okay, is anyone sick? Does anyone, like, my daughter forgot her soccer cleats. Like, I try to be available for the kids. And sometimes when you're writing, I'm sure you know, you're like subconsciously longing for distraction, because it's hard. So sometimes I'll catch myself checking email and realize, and this is again where the mindfulness came into very helpful, of like, I'll catch myself clicking over to email and be like, why am I doing this right? This is my writing time. And be like, oh, it's because I'm really struggling with the scene. And my brain just went immediately to like something that would be a good distraction. And then I can catch myself before I get sucked into email and come back to my writing and keep writing. Mm-hmm. So I it's not that I never get distracted. It's just that I've gotten much better at catching myself and coming back to the writing before I get too sucked into whatever it is was going to distract me.
Do you think the meditation is a part of that that's helped you?
Hugely. Yes. Yeah. Like, big yes. Yeah.
It's interesting. A lot to think about. Thank you so much for taking
the- Yeah.
I really do love your book, and I think I read it in maybe 2 days.
Thank you. That's so sweet. It's always nice to hear.
Yeah,
thank you.
I know. It's great to hear, but it's true. And I wanted to talk about the ending. And well, you know what? We're at the end of the interview. This, I can put out a spoiler alert right now, so that if you do not want to hear about the ending, turn this off right now, because we're going to spend a few minutes talking about it. I've done this a few times recently, and it's kind of interesting because I want to know.
Yeah, usually we don't get to talk about the ending. Fun.
We don't get to talk about it. So I'm going to wait for everybody to turn off the podcast. Okay, they turned it off. Now, I really like how you brought Mom back and how she sort of saved the day and then disappeared. Was that your intention, or when did you know that that was going to happen, that she was going to come back into the story and be kind of a pain in the butt to begin with and then come through for her daughter?
Yeah, I think I knew that. That was always kind of an underlying theme. So I grew up on Westerns. I love Westerns. And nowadays you cannot say that you're writing a Western because no one will touch you with a 10-foot pole. Mm-hmm. But in the traditional structure of a Western, there's a problem that needs solving that requires like a violence that your character is not capable of, right? And then there's this, there's a stranger who comes to town who has, he's the one who can do the thing that needs to be done. And then he leaves and he takes all that evil with him. Like there's a certain amount of bad behavior that has to be employed to solve the problem. And that bad behavior can't stay in the community without tainting it. And that's why like the Western hero always has to ride off into the sunset. And of course I didn't want to write it exactly like that, but I always kind of saw Tallulah's mom as that character. You know, she was never going to be anyone she wasn't, but she really does care for her daughter. And the only thing she can really contribute is the solution to this thing that is plaguing her daughter. And then she has to go, like she has to leave because she doesn't fit in that world. And she certainly doesn't fit after doing what she does. And I see her as such a tragic, loving, good-hearted person who just cannot get herself together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was perfect. I thought it was just such a perfect ending, ending and perfect that she did that and was shocked at herself for doing it because she thinks she's doing something else. She doesn't realize it's her brother. And then she leaves and I like that the farm carries on. The ranch carries on, you know.
It's, yeah.
Abigail is there and
Yeah. And everything's a little bit different. I mean, Tallulah's mm-hmm. lost a finger, as long as we're giving spoilers. You know, there are a couple of the birds are missing. Like everything has changed a little bit. And presumably the barn will have to be rebuilt and it will be a different place than it ever was. But I feel like that's really appropriate for a place for Tallulah to step into as her own person and live life on her own terms.
How did the ending come about? I mean, is this like the beginning where you just had to mess with it, do various versions to get it right? Or did you know when you got there that this is how it has to end?
I pretty much knew that this was how it had to end. There were variations like the violence of the finger loss and the specifics of who gets injured in what way. There was a version where that's the night that Christine goes into labor. Mm-hmm. Or so like everything happens at once. I decided to space that out. So there was some tweaking of the specifics, but I always knew it had to end with Uncle Steve's demise and a fire. And I just kind of worked from there.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was great. So thank you. Thank you so much for,
thank you for having me. As like I said, I love talking craft. So it's fun to talk with other writers.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was April Davila, author of 142 Ostriches, published by Kensington. The show was produced by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Music and sound editing by Travis Barrett. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, more at penonfire.com.